Welcome to the 100th Monkey with Tom and Ramon. I'm back this week. I took a little break last week, and thank you so much, Claudia. You did such a wonderful job. And let me push you towards doing your own show because
Absolutely.
you did such a wonderful job that you need to have your own show. Off to the business end of it. Don't forget, we're still doing the trip to Damanhur, so sign up. I'm still working with them on trying to get prices for lodging and everything. So you can go right and sign up. If you're about 50% sure, please go ahead and sign up. That doesn't mean that you have to go.
Yeah,
It just means
what'd
that
they say
you.
the week at Damanhur was 550 euro? Is that right, Ramon?
550 euro.
Okay, but
So.
that doesn't include food or lodging either. So,
Or airplane ticket.
right. So, anyways, we're working on it, guys.
Yeah. Don't forget to donate if you can. Everything counts. We don't charge for our subscription, but we might have to start that next month. So if you can, please donate whatever you can. We're not asking for huge amounts. What it costs you for a New York deli coffee will be suffice. And also you can get our shows downloaded on iTunes, or you can go to Podbean, which is right at the top of the page. And let's see, anything else we need to cover?
Well, I wanna welcome all the new countries. We're up to what is it? We've got 78 different countries that are listening now. I want to welcome Cambodia, French Polynesia, Serbia, China, Portugal, Slovenia, Angola, Paraguay, the Czech Republic, Luxembourg, Angola, Latvia, and Trinidad. I want to welcome all you guys to our listening audience. That's pretty awesome. Tonight we have a pretty special guy. He's been talking on this material for quite a while. James Horrocks lived a life filled with connection, communication, and interaction with our off-world family, and has been sharing what he's come to know with many through many interviews and videos and a blog site at. You might want to write this down and go check this out during this interview. You can kind of browse through there while we're talking. It's evmsinfo.blogspot.com. He's got just a ton of really good information and links there that you guys will really enjoy. And so I want to welcome James to the show. James, how are you doing tonight?
All right, thank you.
Yes.
It's my pleasure.
Oh, it's our pleasure to get you on here. There's so much that we're going to go into and cover tonight that I hope we delve into some areas that I haven't heard about yet.
Yeah, make sure you guys get your pen and papers because James is just full of information. So sit down, pay attention in class.
Yeah. Keep your hands inside the vehicle at all times. How's Brooks doing? Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's okay. Go ahead, Ramon. What do you got?
I was gonna start off with all the stuff that the global elite are doing, us as individuals, because there was one person who called up and someone that I got to meet, and her name is escaping me right now.
Oh, yeah.
But is it
Hi,
Aya?
hiya.
Hiya. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that, James. She called you up on Kevin Smith's show, and
Yes, she's a regular.
yeah, she and you can hear her frustration, which is the same with me and Tom. What else can we do? Because it almost seems like we're in a boxing match with a centipede.
Well, you have to work what works to your advantage. And one thing that works to your advantage, you're playing with people whose comfort zone is extraordinary. And they have a great deal at risk by taking the steps they've planned to take. That's why they have postponed deadlines several times in the last 12 years and have backed out of a number of things like mandated H1N1 vaccine and a number of other intentions that they had with respect to how they want to go about implementing the final stages of the feudal police state that is or will, might be, the New World Order.
So we've now, got... Go ahead, Tom.
No, I was going to say, there's this, to change the topic just a little bit, there's this new, well, not that new, but this kind of a money that's called Bitcoin. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
Okay. I'm wondering if that is actually what it says it is, or is it something being put out there by them as of, you know, to give you the illusion that it's like a free money market trade away from those things, or is just another version of the same thing?
Well, it's a test, something for them to provoke a reaction and poll it, like sticking your toe in water to make sure it's not too hot. And they've done this off and on. I can remember over 20 years ago when most countries in South America were printing banknotes that were virtually blank on one side. And that was basically that in the course of printing, if suddenly there was a regime change towards another ideology or program, that they could have something to fill in that would comply with that particular protocol.
Yeah, I can see how they do a lot of their little tests out there in the guise of altruistic people that are trying to accomplish something.
Well, they're not brave. They're not brave. That's another thing. Of course, they consider bravery to be foolhardiness. But, of course, when you are on the inside of the turn, bravery is all you've got.
You know, you've mentioned in another interview, I think it was one of the Kevin Smith shows, that there's like something like 2 million insiders that have an idea of what's going on.
At least.
Yeah, well, out of that 2 million, it seems to me that with that many and the changes of consciousness that are going on right now, you know, geologically, politically, sociologically, I mean, the full spectrum, the changes that are happening right now, I would think that there'd be more coming out and speaking about what they know.
Well, let me give you an example. Now, this is a little bit off our track right here, but it's an excellent example to show you the kind of mentality we're dealing with. Now, the American Medical Association has more doctors than they need. It was only a few years ago that there was a major break with the AMA's policy regarding a particular B group factor, folic acid. Along with the FDA, that of course was influenced by the pharmaceutical companies, they had determined a very, very low, very insignificant amount of folic acid to be critical, and any more than that, of course, would be toxic, right?
Okay.
Well, folic acid is the most critical of the entire B group. Without it, nothing else, none of the other B group is actually excipiated because it excipiates them all, with the exclusion of some that are actually taken intravenously. But the false presumption or the false assertion that the adequate amount of folic acid was under a milligram, when people were taking up to 50 milligrams of B1, B2, B6, was outrageous because as the great lady of nutrition, Idell Davis, determined in 1968 with one of the best researched books ever written on nutrition, Let's Get Well. She refers to the need for folic acid over all other B group, and that when you take extraordinary amounts of the other B group, you create the deficiency that's already there of folic acid to be more and more critical. You're starving the mind. So, in fact, one of the leading tranquilizers does exactly that. It's an inordinate amount of B1, thiamine hydrochloride, which starves the mind of other more essential B group vitamins and vitamin factors. So, finally, things got so bad with pregnancy. So many babies were being born with these critical deficiencies that obstetricians and pediatricians broke with the AMA and started giving what had been concerned to be toxic doses of folic acid to their expectant mothers. And this reversed a trend towards babies that were born with non-congenital defects. And overnight, the AMA quietly permitted this. Of course, they didn't make any noise about it. But this is the kind of thing we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who only under great stress, facing the harshest of realities, will come clean against the peer pressure of their fellow doctors or their profession.
Right. Right.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Well, it cut birth defects by 40% the first 6 months.
Wow.
But, of course, that was a toxic amount of folic acid.
Right.
In your opinion, is there an example of that now where they're still saying that something is toxic? For example, the vitamin B17, is that correct?
Oh, that's very interesting. Anything that's natural, derived naturally, doesn't go through the synthesis that pharmaceutical companies perform on every organic compound in order to not have something all that good, all that curative. You can't find very many nutrients that are organically produced that have any toxic level whatsoever. The body just, if you get too much of any one thing, you get a repugnance to it, a natural repugnance.
Right.
Unless it does have a low-level toxicity, which if it's natural, it's probably not going to have. There are exceptions. Belladonna. There are things that are derived from the bark of most trees, things that are derived from some roots, but they have therapeutic. They don't have what I would call nutrient value.
Very interesting. My daughter'd be the one to. She's into all the nutrients and the vitamins and stuff. Me, I'm just a complete. I'll plead complete ignorance. I have not done any investigation in that area.
But I'll bet she knows who Adele Davis is.
She probably does, yes.
Yeah. The vitamin B17, for those of you who don't know, comes from the pits of peaches.
Apricot seeds.
And it's actually illegal to sell them or take them in the United States. So that's why I was bringing them
up. Really? Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, the compound associated with that is pangamate. And this was so popular in the Soviet Union that they were putting it on every table in Siberia. It was in a salt shaker. And the reason they were doing that is that they had many cases each year of gangrene from frostbite. And if you were eating this, or if you started eating this during any overexposure, it improved the circulation up to 22 times normal. So you weren't as likely to lose a limb from gangrene. But the most interesting thing I ever saw where this was used to revitalize tissue was a hand that was replaced on a Chinese factory worker that had laid on the floor 8 hours before it was retrieved and reattached to the man who gained eventually 78% use of that hand that had been severed, laid on the factory floor for 8 hours before it was,
wow.
And of course, it was revived with calcium pangamate solution. And I saw an 8-hour film of the operation. I had one huge team of surgeons performing it. And you think in terms of what can be done. If the resources are put to it, miracles can be performed, and that they're not here in the United States is a sin.
Right. Well, we have there are so many different plants and minerals that are just laying right on the ground that have such amazing properties, and they have been just. Oh, the crap that the government's doing with all the vitamins and all the supplements, trying to regulate them, and it just makes me sick that they're trying to take nature completely out of what we're able to have access to here.
Well, that is a large part of what's behind denuding the rainforests. Denuding the rainforest to get rid of Aboriginal peoples, to get rid of hinterland, a place for alternative lifestyles that may not be friendly to the New World Order. A number of things going on here, rape of resources and so forth. But, you know, bear in mind that if they provide the planet with this monstrous design of depopulation, what the devil are they going to need all those resources for?
Right. Now, it's always baffled me. What, you know, it just doesn't make sense that anybody would want to do such destruction to the planet and still think that there's going to be a pleasant place to live.
I mean, well, you know, I know there's a lot of speculation about what happened in your country. And, you know, there is one science that has not been heard from on the score of this 9.2 to 9.6 earthquake that you had. And that's seismology.
We had an earthquake last night, actually.
You know, do you know what the severity was, what the magnitude?
It was so slight. No, I don't know, but it was so slight that you can barely see the water in the cup. We always keep a cup of water on the table for that reason.
That's your that's your canary in the coal mine.
Right? There you go.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, seismologist. What is a seismologist? A seismologist is someone that has worked down the science of prognostication, being able to predict an earthquake.
Right.
And they can do it so well. The science is so perfect that they can predict earthquakes days in advance. But Fukushima wasn't predictable.
Yeah.
So what caused Fukushima?
Yeah, there's a lot of anomalies associated with that whole setup there.
Well, I can give you, I can give you a you know, I long... For the last 9 months before Fukushima had been expecting something to happen to Japan, something disastrous. And I'll give you. Would you like to
absolutely
yes.
Participate in a little conspiracy analysis?
Let's go ahead and go down that road.
On this show,
anything and everything is where we go.
Do you remember in the 70s when Japan out of nowhere had a banking crisis where your yen was like 125 to the dollar and all
right.
of a sudden it fell to 275 to the dollar and there was banks closing, there were all kinds of, your stock market was in shambles.
Right.
Do you know what caused that?
No.
Well, just prior to that, Japan had contracted all of Kuwait's oil. They were going to build refineries in Japan, and they were going to refine it for export. Now, that's the biggest no-no against Standard Oil, who has a monopoly on that. And you can imagine the rancor that the Seven Sisters, Big Oil, felt over that. There are other reasons other than just that monopoly or that cartel, but there are other reasons too. And one of them was what you might, in the course of refining, you might discover the secrets about helium that they don't want you to know about. So when the Japanese contracted this and started building their refineries, they started looking for tankers. Nobody had any tankers to lease them. They went to shipyards. Nobody would build them any tankers. They tried to buy tankers that were up for sale in different countries. Nobody would sell them to them. And that's when your yen fell dramatically. Well, they got even with Japan. They waited a few years to get even with Kuwait. And there is a transcript between the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, a lady, Saddam Hussein, and she encourages him to do whatever he needs to do to settle the long-term dispute between himself or between Iraq and Kuwait over not having a port on the Persian Gulf. Not anything over slant drilling for oil or any of the confusion that you've heard. The issue was him putting Kuwait in a position to actually allow him the real estate so that Iraq could have a port on the Persian Gulf. They don't have one on the Persian Gulf. So, and they once had ownership of that land. So Saddam, she said, well, I guess you should need to do what you need to do. Perhaps it'll bring peace to the Middle East. So he started his military buildup on his border with Kuwait. Nothing happened, so he invaded. Now they got even with Kuwait, didn't they? Hmm. Well, okay, over a year ago, about a year before the catastrophe at Fukushima, I was reading in the Arab news. Guess what? Japan had contracted Kuwait's oil again, and this time the refineries were being built in Vietnam.
Ooh.
I did not hear about that one.
Well, your Japanese trading companies like Mitsui have. Yeah, no, I mean, you're not hearing a lot of things. We're not getting this type of information here either. In fact, I've been talking about this many years, and people just don't want to believe it. But you can research it for yourself. It's there. Let me assure you, though, the powers that be are that petty, that monstrous, and they'll do that. They don't pick up their marbles and leave. They stomp they stomp everybody into the ground they were playing with. That's how they behave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I always heard a saying, never trust an animal that eats its own.
And they do. They do.
They definitely do.
They do. Yeah. Well, well, you know, the way they get around that is that they, the upper class, the elite, are feudal. They practice primogeniture. The eldest son in every family controls everything. If any of his brothers, any of his sisters.
Hang on. What was that word you used, primogeniture?
Yeah. That means the eldest son gets everything.
Okay. I've not heard that term before.
It's a feudal term.
Okay.
It's under feudalism, every estate, that feudal estate is governed by a lord. They may have a higher title than lord, but that means that they are mandated that title by the crown. And lands and a certain amount of subsidy go with it.
Right.
But it can become, it's worse than slavery because the serfs that are in your fiefdom are attached to the land. They can never leave.
Right.
You can't trade them or whatever. They are attached to the land. And that's what these monsters want to bring back. Of course,
they've got their foot in the door with our maritime law crap with all your names in all capital letters so that they create a corporation out of the person to be able to market that person's assets on the market.
Well, the biggest thing about that is it permits them to obtain in every jurisdiction law by contract and not by constitution or social contract.
Right.
So they can consider you in a proprietary sense, and deal with you that way, but. I've seen copies of a constitution that was ratified in early American times that did not permit any lawyer, anyone that had taken an oath before the bar, to run for public office at any level. And that was lost.
Yeah, conveniently.
It was lost, yeah, yeah. But it's probably a defining document because our forefathers, even up to Andrew Jackson, had a common sense approach to corruption. You've heard of Alexander Hamilton, haven't
right.
you?
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Where he was killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. And now, as the story goes, Aaron Burr was a renegade. But nobody ever asked what he was renegading from. He wanted to start a new republic free from the elite of New England. And Alexander Hamilton typified that very element. Alexander Hamilton was first treasurer of the United States. He knew that the war bonds that had been sold to keep Washington's army going at Valley Forge through the harshest winter of that century would be redeemed at full value. He knew that. It was insider information, wasn't it? So he sent his agents out with rumors that they'd be lucky to get 10 cents on the dollar, and bought up all of those at 10 cents on the dollar.
Right.
And that's how the Hamilton fortune was founded. Few people know how our eminent people of rank and prestige that are in the social register in America got their fortune started. But the two most common ways of starting their fortune was slaving or wrecking. And now wrecking is a pretty interesting little occupation. Do you know what it is?
Is that when, for example, they did that a lot in New York, where you flood an environment with drugs and guns, and then you buy up the land really cheap?
Well, that's,
and then you turn them all into condos.
That's something that they do, and they've done in my town here, and they've done all over. What they do is the right of eminent domain, and then they just come in and take down all the lower all the working class and indigent people's housing, put them out on the streets, and build these condos for wealthy people or upper middle class, but who want to be more convenient to downtown. No, wrecking is much older tradition. Wrecking is you have the shoals here, Chesapeake, different New England coasts have some pretty rotten, pretty bad shoals. So they have lighthouses, don't they?
Right.
Or you just move the lighthouse to where these ships are coming in on the shoals, and when they wreck, you go out and salvage them.
Oh, wow.
And they had whole towns. They had whole towns. That was their entire livelihood. Wrecking. And, of course, the town magistrate or whatever might be, he would take a bigger share. And so they amassed quite a bit of wealth. But what it was a form of piracy, basically. But, I mean, nobody got arrested for it. And a lot of wealthy families that became elite, that became upper class, got their start from that. So if you've ever read Bertolt Brecht's Threepenny Novel, it'll give you in London. London's very interesting in many respects. They had an institution called gaming. It actually started out as bear baiting, and it continued until about the 1890s.
Bear baiting? Okay.
Bear baiting was medieval. It began medieval times. Chaucer wrote about it. You dug a big pit, and you threw you scanned the empire to find lions and interesting animals, and you threw them in the pit to watch them kill each other. And everybody made bets and everything. That was later on, by Victorian England, it had refined into involving humans with the animals. And one of them, I knew a gentleman who was a ratter. And rat terriers were bred for this. And he would get his favorite ratter, and they would turn loose 50 rats in this ring. And he would tie his hands behind his back. His teeth would be sharpened, and he would wait until the dog became kill wary. The dog would kill maybe half the rats or more. And then he'd have to go in with his hands tied behind his back and kill the rest of them, and their bets would be on how fast or how much time it would take for him to do it. They had men that fought every day that they lived in combat where they could be killed very easily. There were prodigies that came out of that came to the United States. And there's one gentleman who was probably had the fastest hands in history, who never weighed more than 140 pounds, and nobody could stand up to him. I mean, he could take any heavyweight today and knock him out with one blow. And this guy was he came to the United States, and he would go around to circuses and things, and He'd have a hawker, and the hawker would get the bet up against somebody that was advertising that they would I could go three rounds with anybody, and if you could go three rounds with them, that they, you know, that you'd right. win the bet, and they'd get that bet up as high as I could get it, and they'd go in there, and then they'd say, "Well, what if I knock you out in the first round? You want to double the bet? Oh, you can't do that. Yeah, let's." And of course, he always won.
And, so who was this?
I'm trying to think. I'll try to get his name for you. Okay. It's I haven't talked about him in so long, but the gentleman was quite interesting. And what was extremely interesting about him is that he wasn't educated, but he was very educable, and he had become a literary prodigy too, and. He liked Shakespeare, and he liked Christopher Marlowe, and very, very, very in-depth analysis of what he read. And he liked my favorite book, which is Moby Dick.
Good stuff.
Yeah, that's a book I haven't read the whole thing.
Really?
Oh, you need to.
Oh, Ramon.
There's something.
I was
in
supposed
that.
To read it in junior high school, and you know, I got busy.
There's something about that book that I place. I like Joseph Conrad very much, but although Conrad, across the board, was an incredible writer, he wrote in English, and his native language was Polish. He was an astounding writer. But Melville's Moby Dick, I think, is the greatest American novel. And there's, if I was teaching literature, I would have the students gasping at what I would tell them about that book.
Not to be offensive, but I don't know how long they would keep you as a teacher.
They wouldn't. I mean, the best teachers are the ones that are not teaching, because they're not going to follow a syllabus. They're not going to destroy a child's love of learning. And all children begin as curious. They all can master several languages if you teach them before they're four. They can still master them by seven, but after seven, you become like me. You become rather, I don't have the ear for languages that other people have, but especially French.
Yeah, I remember the teachers were trying to convince my mother that consistently talking to the child in two different languages was not good for them. And my mother didn't buy into it, which is a good thing.
Yes, well, you want to copy the way that the child is learning their language when they first start talking, and they're mimicking. And a child is a perfect mimic. They mimic first, and then the meaning fills in. And it's just like, and it can happen so fast. And the more languages you learn, the more you appreciate your own. It's a depth thing. And sometimes you reach a level where you're thinking in another language. Some people can't do that for the same reason some people can't speed read, because speed reading is a matter of how many cones and rods are in the eye. It's not a matter of a technique. Sure, people's eyes can pass over letters, but that's not reading. And how many people do you know that speed read actually retain anything? I mean, they'll talk about statistics and everything, but when you start dealing with people, I know you've been on forums, how many people can follow a thread and really keep up with it? In any depth or with any precision,
right?
They don't, right. And you can bet that there. If you say you got 50 people, and And they're all there on this forum together. And you ask them, how many of you speed read? You're going to find out. Most of them will say they do. And, you know, you're seeing the effects of using something whose benefit is not just minimal. It's probably non-existent.
So, okay, I want to jump back into a little of the conspiracy stuff here. Well, I don't know what category this really goes into, but kind of baffles me that the masses are not able to see what's happening right above our heads in the skies with the chemtrail issue, and they're not demanding answers. In my own opinion, I see several different purposes that these things could have. One would be to block cosmic or solar waves or energy waves that are coming in now that have the potential to have a change within humanity. Another one would be just flat out weather manipulation, and a third possibility would be the depopulation agenda, control over the food supply, and a media to administer elements that could dumb down or create disease with the masses. Where do you stand on that? What do you understand about the chemtrail issue?
All of the above.
All of the above.
I'll give you an example really quickly before you answer that question, James. About 2 weeks ago, we had a typhoon coming up, and it was coming up from the south. Now, I've never heard of this, and I could be wrong. The typhoon was coming up north, going northwest, and it decided that it was too early, and it turned around and started going south. And at the speed that it was going very slow. And a lot of the Japanese people here were saying, oh, that's really slow, that's odd. I've never heard of that. And all, you know, old people were saying this. So is that a natural occurrence or was it pushed?
Well, I would need more information on that. But if the older people who are very experienced with the way in which these things are normal to their region, if they're saying things like that, then there's a good chance that the abnormality brings suspicions up about these being created. We know they can do this. We know that that is part of the only purpose of HAARP. We know that the information that you could get from the waves, both sound waves, that they can generate with HAARP. This has already been done with nuclear blasts. So there's nothing there for them to discover with HAARP. So the applications of HAARP are weather control, earthquakes, and just plain all-around havoc. You know, I mean, if you can control the weather, if you can create heavy rain saturation over an area long enough to flood it, you know, it's real interesting that about the time that the initial fallout reached San Francisco and L.A., both of these cities were inundated with abnormal amounts of heavy saturating rain. So where the atmospheric monitors, which were the only monitors which were measuring radiation in the area, were inconclusive, nobody thought to check the water and check the soil there, because it had all come down through the atmosphere very quickly, and it gathered in the bays and lakes and the ground. And so, and those were areas of concern because the way that this the Bay Area and L.A. in a mountain valley Everything gets blocked in there. It holds in smog. It holds in clouds and so forth. So this was an area that could be saturated very easily with high levels of radiation, radioactive isotopes, which it most certainly was. But they are finding dangerous levels in lakes in Canada and of radioactive isotopes. And most people that have Geiger counters don't realize that unless they paid $7,500 for that Geiger counter, it's not reading most radioactive isotopes.
Right, right.
So you've got that problem. I go along with Lorraine Murray, a scientist and a very nice lady. She calls it like it is, and she places these so-called natural disasters as genocidal weapons, and I think they are. I think we're going to start seeing the hospitals filling, and it will get so bad where the media will lose its credibility altogether for lying to the people. There was a movie made in the United States in 2007, and it was banned here. It was made here, and it was banned here, shown elsewhere.
What was it called?
It was called Toxic Skies, and it was fiction, but let's face it, we're in a situation today, just like the writers of novels and have been in repressive societies like Imperial Russia, Tsarist Russia, the Russia that Dostoevsky, Turgenev, people like Solzhenitsyn were involved in writing for, and they had to work their genius in a very subtle way, or be shot. But we're in a situation where more truth, more revelation is in our fiction than in our media.
I will agree with that.
And so this movie is a good example of it. And it was the first that I had seen to consider the binary weapon nature or binary weapon potential of chemtrails. And no wonder it was banned here. But the next person, it wasn't until this year when Lorraine Murray was talking about her conversation with another scientist who disclosed this to her in secrecy. He said chemtrails are a part of a binary weapon system, and that what he's talking about is with the geoengineers that give presentations trying to apologize or being apologists for chemtrails, trying to say that this is just, we're trying to cool the planet down. Sure. Sure. They'll say, well, they'll admit to barium, strontium, and aluminum. Well, what do these metals do when you're taking them in every day? They destroy your immunity. So that's the first half of a binary weapon system. And in the movie, what happens is that they start trying to treat some of the people that have been traveling and contracted the bubonic plague. And these people are not getting the benefit of any treatment. They're dying left and right, just as fast as if you didn't treat them at all, so that they're trying to figure out what's going on. And they find out that chemtrails are destroying any hope for these people. And if they contract any of the diseases for which we haven't been confronted in our life, like smallpox, and they have had the exposure to these chemtrails and this barium, strontium, aluminum cocktail, they're dead. Period. No hope. And it's an agonizing way to die. But that's not the only aspect here. First, if you've got something that you've got people used to, like your drinking water, for instance, like your food supply, and we know what's Monsanto's doing to that, along with General Mills. We know. But you take your water there. I hear rumors they're adding lithium. Well, I believe it's true. But I know this, that I filter my water. And I, in order to recover my filters and you a little economically, I take, if these filters are carbon filters, I'll take and soak them in vinegar, which chelates what they have removed. And when I run water through there, it'll come out. It'll come out, and I can reuse the filter after it dries. So I started noticing that I was getting funny-looking little crystals. So last night I spent a little time. These crystals, calcium bromate.
Really?
Yeah. That's not good. That's in my drinking water here. And I'm not getting it all out with my filters. So now I hear rumors that they are also adding lithium. That's a behavioral chemical.
Right.
But, you know, they are really trying to reduce us down to where we can't think straight. We can't reach complex reasoning situations that we have to work out like a problem, where we are more emotional. They don't care what we do to each other. I mean, they're insulated from us, right?
Right.
They don't care if we eat each other. That's probably amusing to them. But I firmly believe that there is a point at which we're going to start wanting some degree of healthy outrage back to the human animal.
Yep, and I think we're getting there.
I'm waiting for that. You know, I've always said that when you put a man in a position where he has nothing to lose,
yeah,
he has nothing to lose.
Yeah.
It's a very dangerous man.
Yeah.
It's
okay. Well, we are coming close to the top of the hour already, and in the second hour, I'd like to get into the EMVs and some of the off-world stuff that you are familiar with, and I'm sure that we could go on this topic for hours and hours and hours. I know there's a lot out there that needs to be addressed, and we'll look at some of the solutions that we can address in the next hour or two, because there are answers out there. There are things that we can do, and there's a lot of us that are doing them. And, so, James, for the first hour on BBS, would you like to leave us with some parting statements?
Well, no. I've enjoyed it, no parting statements. I'm looking forward to the next hour.
Okay, great.
Make sure you catch Dr. Brooks coming up next.
Yep, and then pop over into the archives and check us out at www.the100thmonkeyradio.com. Condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance. Ramon?
And if you call, I was going to say, if you call into a Brooks show, let them know we said hi.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, guys, we love you all, and we'll see you in the second hour.